Well, you guys, I'm just almost at 5,000 interviews now. It looks like it should be this Friday. And now I have this one to add to the very bottom of the list. My long-lost first interview I ever did on Free Radio Austin 97.1 FM in 1999 with surviving Branch Davidian David Thibodeau. Well, part of it, at least. All the tapes of my first show, Say It Ain't So, were stolen out of my friend's storage shed years ago, so this is one of the very few recordings of it that remain. An old friend from Chaos Radio had it and posted it on YouTube, which served it up to me in the margin just a couple of months ago. So thanks to Mad Dr. S for that, and also thanks very much to Jeremy Deal for helping me to clean up the audio at least as much as possible. So here you go, my first interview from 20 years ago, David Thibodeau.
Well, everybody listening out there, this is Free Radio Austin 97.1. You're listening to Say It Ain't So. I'm talking with a very fine gentleman by the name of David Thibodeau, who is a survivor of the fire at Mount Carmel that was set by the federal government. And in fact, before I forget, there was something in your book that this was the first time I had ever heard this, and this definitely goes to show toward the fact that they were planning on murdering all of you guys the whole time. Tell us about the order of body bags, David.
Oh, yeah. Good point. Well, there's a couple of very disturbing reports that I've collected through all this. One, of course, where you recall the Parker Memorial Hospital at 6 a.m. the day of the fire, 6 hours before the fire. The FBI called and asked how many beds were available in the burn unit. And then basically, they should expect burn victims by noon. And of course, the only reason that little bit of information came out is because the FBI was going to refuse to pay Parker Memorial Hospital for the Davidian burn victims. And Parker Memorial Hospital was going to sue because of this phone call that occurred 6 hours earlier. And they said, you absolutely knew there was going to be a fire. You called us. And we'll take you to court on it. And, you know, when that occurred, they obviously said, oh, well, we don't want to do that. Let's just pay for the burn victims. And the second thing was a few days before the fire, a call was put into couple of the mortuaries in Waco, Texas, and they put in an order for over 80 body bags so they could have the body bags on hand.
My friends, did you hear that? Say it ain't so out there. I mean, come on. They ordered over 80 body bags how many days, 2 days before?
It was anywhere from like, I think it was like a week before.
Okay. Say it ain't so, my friend. That just blows me away. That's absolutely incredible. Ladies and gentlemen, friends and neighbors, boys and girls, we're talking to David Thibodeau. He's the author of a new book called A Place Called Waco, A Survivor's Story. Again, I must reiterate, in case anybody's just tuning in, everything you ever knew about Waco or thought that you knew, whatever lies you might have believed, etc., all came from the point of view of the government surrounding the place, full of demonized people. And even if you've seen the rules of engagement, even if you have read The Davidian Massacre by Carol Moore or something like that, this is the first real taste of finding out what it was like inside Mount Carmel during this siege. You get to find out why David was there. You get to find out what the federal government did to these people from the perspective of inside the house. And I just... that cannot be denied to anyone. Anyone with the slightest interest in this, or anyone out there who says that me and my friend David here are nothing but a couple of kooks and that the government is harmless, I challenge you to go read this book and tell me when you're done whether the government is harmless or not. It's called A Place Called Waco, A Survivor's Story by David Thibodeau. And I gotta recommend that everybody rush out and get a copy. Before we get into all the questions and answers here real quick, Waco woke me up. See, I always knew I didn't really like George Bush very much or what have you. But the fact that the demonization of Davidians, I guess that's not even really what you guys are supposed to be called anyway, but the demonization was so effective, I realized that we had to have a really big problem for this to be able to take place in this country. And I'd also like to say that Waco is what got me interested in talk radio. The first time that I ever heard in my entire life a Davidian side of the story, anyone besides the ATF or FBI describing what happened there, I was flipping through the AM stations here in town, and I heard, I believe it was Catherine Madison on another station here in town, and I realized it hit me, it struck me for the first time that I didn't even realize this was the first time I had ever heard what one of the people inside Mount Carmel had to say. And so to me, that just shows the power of talk radio, because now here I am carrying it on myself. My friends, David Thibodeau has a brand new book called A Place Called Waco, A Survivor's Story, which I'm sure you can get a copy of anywhere. I went and got mine at Book People. It's autographed and everything. An excellent book. I guess, David, we should just start at the beginning. Who are you? Where are you from? And how'd you get to Waco?
Well, I grew up in Bangor, Maine, of all places. And, you know, after I was a small-town high school kid, I just wanted to get out and make it to L.A. and start pursuing my dream of being a drummer in a band and, you know, doing something with that. So I went out to Los Angeles and I went to music school. And make a long story short, I ended up meeting David Krish and Steve Schneider at a guitar center on Sunset Boulevard, of all places. And we just kind of started talking. They, you know, they gave me their card. And, of course, I had all this religious scripture on the back, and I wasn't really looking to get into any kind of Christian band at the time, or, you know, living in Hollywood, you're very wary of cults and religious groups, obviously. And it just wasn't my thing. But after listening to them talk for a little while, I could tell that they actually had something of depth. They didn't come off preachy or religious at all. They just came off like they had a knowledge of what was really happening. And as I got to know these people over the course of the next couple months, I could see that they had incredible insight, and it became something that I genuinely wanted to know. I mean, I always knew there was a mystery behind the Bible. I mean, I knew that millions of people throughout the course of history didn't die for the scripture for nothing. I mean, there had to be a power behind it. And, you know, I knew that it was something that I wanted to understand, if nothing else, from a historical aspect. Basically, I had all my questions answered beyond any comprehension that I was prepared to receive at the time.
So at the time, you weren't particularly looking for any sort of Christian message, and then even after you met Koresh, it wasn't so much his personality or his friendship that you gained that got him interested. It was actually the depth of his knowledge of the Bible that got you listening to him. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, his eyes didn't glow. I mean, he wasn't, you know, that charismatic of a person that people like to think. You know, he was just very real and honest about what was happening and what his beliefs were. And like I said, I mean, he could just not only answer every question you ever had, but when he gave a study, for example, it was like he was there. It was like he had lived it, which made it just phenomenal. I mean, the guy, it's like he was both Revelation and Genesis, and everything in between put into the flesh. And that's the simplest way I can describe something that has taken me months to come to a conclusion that there was truth there. And that's why it's so hard to really get into what it was all about, what it was all like. Yeah, you know, in writing the book, A Place Called Waco, I knew that I would have to, you know, face a lot of things on both sides. But I also knew that I would never be able to really get into depth into the seven seals and be able to really give someone an understanding of who David was. It's just an impossible task.
Is it correct, I believe in your book you state that from what you learned from Koresh, that when he took a trip to Israel in 1985, that he had a vision, and it occurred to him that he pretty much like perceived the entire Bible from start to finish, all just like in one shot.
Yeah, I mean, he had studied, you know, ever since he was a kid. He had memorized certain portions of the book. But when he came back from Israel, and a lot of the old people tell me this too, I mean, before he left, it was Vernon Wayne Howell. He'd been living out there at Mount Carmel for some time, studying under Lois Rhodes, who was a prophetess. Basically, the Mount Carmel community existed out there for 60 years under three different leaders. And each leader claimed they had divine inspiration, but they were all pointing to one that would come in the latter days and would be able to put the whole scripture together. And after 1985, Lois realized that was David Koresh. And then he started to teach the classes and basically take over the group. And the older people tell me that, you know, when he first came onto the scene, he stuttered all the time. He, you know, didn't appear to be all that intelligent, only he could fix the cars and stuff. He worked very hard for the community. But that was basically after 85, everything came together. He stopped stuttering. He became this incredible teacher. And every single one of them believed that he was the one that, all the way back to Brother Hada, who was originally founded the movement out there at Mount Carmel was speaking of was this person David Koresh. So it wasn't just some fly-by-night thing. It's something that the group of people out there had been waiting for a long time, and that the people that had been teaching them had been talking about consistently that this person would come and reveal these seven seals. And then, of course, that was David Koresh that did that.
Okay, I don't really want to spend, and I know you don't want to spend too much time on that. I basically just wanted to, and I think you did a great job of pretty much getting out of the way the whole media hype lie that this guy was some kind of Charles Manson look at you and hypnotize you, a charismatic cult leader, that it really was his message, not himself personally, that was the attraction here at Mount Carmel, right?
Yeah, that's what he always, because I mean, he would always point himself back to the book and say, you know, it's not me. You know, it's scripture that's teaching these things. You know, I'm showing it to you, but you have to see it for yourself. If you think I'm putting my own interpretation here, then let me know, and we'll talk about it further. But if you think that this is what it really says, as he believed, that's what it, you know, what he would go through whole chapters to show you that that's what it really said, that you could basically see it for yourself. So the people there that believed in him, believed in God, believed in the book, more so than they believed in him. He was the person that was pointing the way. And he'd often said that he was like a Dixie cup to be thrown away once he was used. Because, you know, what's the flesh? I mean, we're all going to die. But the only thing we know is that we're born, we're going to die. What happens in between, I think to an extent, is up to you. We do have free moral agency, but we have to choose what we want to do with that life. And I think God opens up a lot of paths once you make the right choices. And for me, I always knew that I was going to have an interesting life. I mean, that it wouldn't be any kind of a normal corporate existence. That my life would be more of an adventure. And in meeting David Koresh, that adventure really began.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're just tuning in, this is Free Radio Austin 97.1, and we're interviewing David Thibodeau, the author of a new book, A Place Called Waco, A Survivor's Story. He escaped out of the front of the building, and so he was not machine gunned like the people in the back were. We'll get to that. Tell me, David, how did you guys first learn that you were under investigation by the federal government?
Well, we realized that there was a place across the street, and these people had moved in. Helicopters were flying very low over the building. Pretty consistently, but when these people across the street moved in, we started to become very suspicious because they were like in their late 30s, early 40s, yet they had Rolex watches, Serengeti sunglasses. There were these four guys that were claiming that they were going to TSDC, which is a community college, yet they're studying philosophy. So their stories didn't fit, and we were very wary. But I think David, one of the agents, Robert Rodriguez, started to come in and get studies with David. And of course, he was there to investigate. But David's attitude was, this person, I don't care who he's with. If he's the FBI, ATF, CIA, it doesn't matter. This person is a soul, and, he has, and if I could show him what I'm all about here, he can see that there's nothing illegal going on. Maybe he can hold off the authority. The music can still go forth. It was planned. We wanted to get the music out, start playing, get an album out, start playing to people, and have them kind of question the truth that way, songs. And so he totally worked with this guy. I mean, we had invited the ATF when they were raiding Henry McMahon, who was a licensed firearm dealer in Hewitt, Texas. And he's a good friend of ours. He started to take David to gun shows and show him the business. The ATF, about 3 months before our raid, raided him, and we're asking him a lot of questions about Koresh. He said, you should ask David personally instead of me. You're here to investigate me, but you're asking questions about Koresh. So he goes into the other room and he gets him on the phone, David Koresh, and he says, David, the ATF are out here, and they're going through all my yellow sheets. They're asking me a lot of questions about you. What do you want me to do? And David said, well, you know what, Henry, have them put him on the phone, I'll talk to him. Have them come on out, they can check any of the, yellow sheets we have on any of our firearms. And, of course, David Aguilera, who was heading up the investigation, kind of pantomimed to Henry McMahon, no, hang up. So we didn't write them out there. They did not want to do it that way. They had an agenda. And, of course, the agenda wasn't just to go in and bust a bunch of religious fanatics. I think they did not want to work with us. They wanted their dynamic entry, what they called Showtime. And I think that is too bad. You know, I mean, it led to the conditions that killed many people. And all they had to do was work with us. They did not want that at all.
Well, and that really is unprecedented in the history of law enforcement for someone under investigation to invite the cops to come on out and for them to refuse. Isn't that an unprecedented kind of way of doing things?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, David had worked with the sheriff, Jack Harwell. He knew him on a first-name basis. And, you know, the sheriff wasn't afraid. The sheriff would have come out and had the past. Yet these people, they didn't want to listen to reason. It's kind of the way I look at it. They had their agenda, and, you know, it's just a terrible thing. I mean, when two cattle trailers filled with men come up to your building, they have three helicopters in the background shooting at the building and firing into it like it's a set of a Rambo movie, and yet they're claiming that they're there to, you know, save and protect the women and children. You know, you have to kind of question their motives. Just say, that sounds like a funny operation.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of hubbub about how the element of surprise has been lost, but in reading your book, it doesn't occur to me that they wanted it to be a surprise at all. I mean, they having the obvious undercover agents living right across the street. Obviously, this guy, Robert Rodriguez, knew that Koresh knew that he was working for the ATF. Even if they hadn't had the media out there all early and if the helicopters hadn't arrived that much earlier than the cattle trailers full of men, it seems like there was no element of surprise to start with for them to lose.
Yeah, I mean, people out there pretty much knew what was going on. I mean, we knew from a scriptural standpoint that something was going to happen to us, and we just never knew to what extent or what how it would actually occur. You know, but the people out there were definitely prepared for some kind of shenanigans by the government. And, you know, of course, the government never took that into consideration. You know, it's just, it just floors me that these people think that, you know, they forget that they're our public servants. You know, and they think that, that they are above the law. And, you know, last time I read the Constitution, that wasn't the case. And this whole, phenomenon of dynamic entry, to me, is just, I think, taking the country in a terrible situation. And it's having a hand in setting this country up as a police state. And if you study history and you understand what happened with Germany under the Nazis and how Hitler did things, you know, it's not that this is not a totalitarian state. This is not a dictatorship, but it follows a lot of the same guidelines. I mean, if you read the gun control laws that Hitler wrote after he came to power, they almost are identical to the American gun control laws.
Well, in fact, that's an excellent point. In fact, I just heard on, I believe it was Liddy's show on another station here in town, he said that the German Gun Control Act of 1938, Hitler's Gun Control Act of 38, was literally translated and sent to the Congress of the United States and was passed as the Gun Control Act of 1968 here in America.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I've gone through some of that material.
Absolutely
it's
insane.
It's very parallel. And, you know, I mean, I just read this thing today. There's all this news breaking all the time. Incidentally, before I forget, you were talking about the book earlier. Anyone that's listening that would like to get a copy of the book can order it directly through me, and that way they can get an autographed copy because, you know, I can't do book signings all the time, but I do like to make myself available to people that are interested. And two ways you can get the book through me is go to my website, which is www.aplacecalledwaco.com, just the title of the book, aplacecalledwaco.com, or you can call me at toll-free at 877-Y-Waco. That's my toll-free number for ordering instructions.
And that's 877-Y-WACO?
Yeah. Which is, I'm going to figure it out on the keyboard here, 949-9226.
And I must recommend this book. I just finished reading it last night, and I'll tell you, as someone who's been interested in this since it originally took place when I was only 16 years old, I've read a lot of articles and a few books, and I've seen, obviously, a lot of videos, and especially Waco, the Rules of Engagement. But it occurred to me, and this is not necessarily for you, Dave, but for the people out there who are interested in this story, all we know about what happened there is from the yard looking at the house. You know, that's the best that we can tell. And, you know, watching the congressional hearings and what have you. But if you want to know what really happened in Waco, you've got to get this book, A Place Called Waco, A Survivor Story. It's just absolutely incredible to understand the Waco siege from the perspective of inside the complex there at Mount Carmel rather than from the FBI's point of view perimeter.
That's never been allowed before. I mean, you know, we made a tape for the public during the 51-day siege, and it was basically all the people were interviewed on the inside. They were all interviewed by Steve Schneider. He was just asking, you know, what's your experience? Do you want to leave? Can you leave at any time? What happened on February 28th? How come you want to stay here? And basically everyone interviewed. I mean, the entire congregation that was in there. And we sent them out this tape, and the FBI, of course, this came out in the congressional hearings. They suppressed that tape from the public, because they felt that it would cause much public sympathy for the Davidians.
Oh, well, sure. I mean, their party line was that this guy was Charles Manson and you guys were all his mindless slaves. And if they had seen that, if we the public, had seen that footage, that would have been the end of that for them right there.
I think about that for a minute. I mean, and them suppressing that and saying, well, this would have caused much public support and sympathy for the Davidians. What are they saying? What they're saying is that there's no way that we can really achieve what we want to achieve here if the public really knows what's going on. So you just got to deal with what we're telling you and take that as face value. You know, the interesting thing is, you know, the political agenda that's in right now, if you will, the Clinton, this entire administration, were basically all around in the 60s. You know, the big 60s mantra was to question authority. And I'd like to know what happened to these people once they came into power. They seem to have forgot that. And now that they're in power, okay, they want to make it illegal for you to question authority. You know, these are the liberals, people. You know, I've seen a complete turnaround in this country where it appears to me that the Democrats have become Republicans. The Republicans literally become the Democrats that I knew, you know, 10 years ago before Clinton came into power. So it's kind of like a pendulum reversal in the nation. And the fact that they can, like, there's a quote I love that really puts it into perspective. And Senator Henry Clay in the 1800s, he said, the devices of power and its minions are the same in all countries and in all ages. First it marks its victim, then denounces it to excite the public hatred, thus concealing its own abuses and encroachments. Now, yeah, think about that for a minute. What Senator Henry Clay was saying is that, you know, for the government to be effective, they're going to go in, they're going to demonize you. They're going to basically wipe you out. And they're going to do this to conceal what they're really doing. You know, that's exactly what Hitler did. This has appeared throughout history over and over and over again. And I have, you know, come to the conclusions in my life that if the sheeple or if the majority of the people feel one way, then I head the other way to find the truth. Because I have seen over and over again in my life how the majority of people don't have a clue as to what's going on, and they don't want to. I mean, I think, like, for example, I have a friend that works at Dell Computer, and he's got my book. He keeps it out on his desk. He says that all day people come by, and they look at the book, and they go, wow, I want to check this out. And they go, they take it to their desk, I read it for like a half hour, go through it, I bring it back to them. They'll say, well, you know, I know this guy, David. He's a friend of mine. If you want a book, just let me know. I'll get you one. He goes, oh, no. We don't want that book. I don't want to have that book in my house.
Oh, yes. What if the SWAT team came to search my house and found your book on my shelf? I might be in even worse trouble.
No, it's some kind of clandestine book. I mean, this is, you know, a major publisher. It's very balanced. And all the reviews, not to float my own boat, but all the reviews are talking about how well-written it is. And yet, you know, there's still this fear out there that it's some kind of naughty thing to learn the truth. And I just have to wonder what is going on. This is America, the land of the free, home of the brave. This is a place where people can come and achieve the idealistic dream and be able to live without any kind of repression. Everyone's running scared now. I mean, the government has become far more powerful than what our constitutional founders and forefathers have wanted it to be. And these are just the points that, you know, my experience is the exclamation mark to that point. And, you know, I think that literally this is the most important event that's ever occurred in America. And for people to ignore it or not care about it, it shows our apathy to, everyone's doing well. You know, no one wants any problems, no one wants to rock the boat.
Well, and no one wants to admit how wrong they were about you guys in the first place. I mean, I meet people now who go, oh, yeah, you know, what happened at Waco? Yeah, that was a bad thing. But they don't really want to get too far into it because they might have to remember just how easily they fell for the party line in the first place. And that's not comfortable.
Well, and also, they may become convicted when something very terrible happened. And once you become convicted, you either move on and live with your conscience or you do something about it. And how many people are really willing to do something about it? I wrote the book in part because I'm worried about that. You know, there's seven people in jail right now. Some of them are in jail for 40 years on a weapons violation that the jury thought was thrown out. In fact, I had spoken with the head jury forewoman, Sarah Bain, and she told me that had the jury been able to hear all the evidence that Judge Walter Smith had suppressed from them, everybody would have been acquitted on all charges. So the fact that they weren't allowed to hear this information is phenomenal that that could happen in this country and that there is a judge to be that powerful.
Right, and this is the same judge that is now presiding over the civil trial, right, and posing as the hero, taking all the evidence from the Justice Department.
We can't get rid of this guy no matter what we do. Walter Smith keeps coming around. And, it's a terrible, terrible a miscarriage of justice. That's why, frankly, you know, I hope for the best. I expect the worst. That's really all I've seen out of this whole experience. And I don't expect that the government, be it Congress or these civil cases, will produce too much. I mean, I hope that they do. But the authorities are so good and so brilliant at spinning things and at keeping things under wraps. I don't know how they do it, I mean, frankly.
It really is incredible. I think, it's been proven to me before how many of the people at the top levels of the mainstream media have master's degrees and PhDs in social psychology. And they definitely put that to use very well. It's just absolutely incredible. In fact, the one that's really getting me lately is now that they're finally talking about this FLIR footage that we've all seen since it came out at the trial and since it was included in Waco, the Rules of Engagement. And they're willing to discuss to a certain extent the gunfire in the backyard, but nowhere is the mention of the double flash in the window at the gymnasium where the fire started.
That's why I bring that point up every single time that I speak. Because, you know, there were two explosions in the back of the building no one's accounted for. And the mainstream won't touch it. They won't touch it. I don't know why. I mean, it was funny to me when all this started to break again that they were concentrating heavily on the fact that a couple pyrotechnic devices were used. What about the explosions? What about the
right. Well, and even the pyrotechnic devices that they admitted to, they sent Danny Colson, the pretend whistleblower, baby killer, to come forward and say, why, yes, we did fire incendiary rounds 50 yards away from the house into a puddle of water 6 hours before the fire broke out. There must be an investigation. You know? So I have a feeling that you're right, at least as far as these so-called congressional and Danforth trilateralist independent investigation. That part is in quotes, the independent part. As far as that goes, I think you're right that we're going to get nowhere, hopefully, at y'all's civil trial. Some more of this stuff will come out.
Yeah, I mean, I feel pretty comfortable that the fact that we have, you know, Rand Clark, who's a former Attorney General of the United States, on this case. Of course, he's our lead counsel. There's two different lawsuits. There's the Houston lawsuit of Cadell, and they're dealing with most of the survivors. Most of the families that lost kids on the inside. And there's Ramsey's suit that is dealing with most of the survivors. don't understand. I mean, even the attorneys. Everyone has gotten such a bad rap on this that it's, you know, you can go into any town, take the most pious old woman in the town, and start a campaign to slander her. And the truth of the matter is, you probably do very well. It takes five positive statements to undo one negative statement.
Just made a really interesting point, David, about how this guy Cadell, the lawyer from Houston, even believes some of their stuff. I noticed one of his quotes in the Dallas Morning News where he talks about how the government lied about not having the ground level footage. The government lied about this. They lied about that. And one of the things that he mentions is that the government lied about not knowing what Koresh was planning in there. And I just thought, wait a minute, man. Now, what angle is this guy going for? Is this guy Cadell, do you think, David, is he going to go for the angle that Koresh did set the fire, but that the Fed should have known and therefore backed off? Or
it appears to be that way, yes.
Well, that's just absolutely sick. I hope that somebody can get a hold of this guy. Well, you tell me, David, you were inside that last day and even the 51 days leading up to that. Did you ever hear any discussion of mass suicide, especially out of the mouth of David Koresh?
No.
Was there ever any plan to commit suicide? And is it or is it not the fact that if you're a Christian, it is a basic part of your belief system that suicide is the worst sin of all because you can't ask for forgiveness afterward?
That's very true. I mean, you know, God gives you life for a reason. And you're supposed to. I mean, you know, this is something that David had said in the past, too. He said that, you know, God can take a whole lifetime to work with someone and bring them around, bring them out of, you know, whatever they're doing, bring them to him. And sometimes it takes a whole lifetime to do that. And, you know, you're basically spitting in the face of God if you kill yourself. I mean, you're giving up that gift and saying that, no, God, you can't do anything for me. I can't take the pain anymore. Well, part of salvation and part of the experience of this life is taking that pain and learning to deal with it.